Welcome to a special episode of the Alpha Exchange, one where we look back on the historic event that was the 1987 stock market crash. This is your host, Dean Kernut, and over the next half hour, we'll bring to life the seismic crash in prices that occurred 35 years ago on October 19th, 1987. I was merely a freshman in college, still learning my way around St. John's University when Black Monday occurred, a decline of 22.6% in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and 20.4% in the S&P 500. It was a day that the VIX, had it been a calculated index at that time, would have closed at 150, almost double the level reached during the GFC and pandemic. It was the realization that selling could beget selling, not just because of the psychology of fear, but because of mechanical trading strategies that existed in the market at that time. So let's get into it and bring to life this truly important day in financial market history through the lens of podcast guests. Along the way, we'll contemplate the lessons learned and the lasting impact of the crash. Jim Bianco, the founder of Bianco Research, was there.
I was in New York City, and I actually worked on 60 Broad Street, which is just a few hundred yards from the New York Stock Exchange. The day after the stock market crash, there was hundreds of people just standing in front of the New York Stock Exchange building right on the corner of Broad and Wall. And it was because they knew something was more important going on in the building. And they wanted to be part of it, and that was the closest they could do to be part of it.
Harry Markopoulos, the man who would gain fame for uncovering the Madoff fraud, was there as well.
My first day as a licensed Series 7 was Monday, October 19th, 1987. And so my job at the firm was to answer calls because my firm's clients were actually short a lot of the over-the-counter names, you know, that were falling rapidly in price. And so we were buying to cover short. And so everybody on Wall Street wanted to call us.
If Harry's firm was buying, just about everyone else was selling. A toxic combination of higher inflation, a weaker dollar, fast rising interest rates, tax law uncertainties, and a market that had become increasingly overvalued collided directly with market structure vulnerabilities and this thing called portfolio insurance. Andy Redleaf, the founder of White Box Capital Management, said this.
The introduction of VAC index futures really changed the ecosystem. When stock index futures were introduced routinely, it changed the market from being the old cliche, you know, a market of stocks instead of a stock market. The introduction of stock index futures dramatically increased correlation. With the introduction of portfolio insurance, which made the broker dealers short a put that nobody else really felt that they were long, and the enhanced correlation, that to me made the possibility of something like a 20% drop more or less instantaneously fairly likely.
The study of market prices and their volatilities is a fascinating, humbling discipline. At a given point in time, the setup is dictated by some complex interaction of risks. Included among these are the economy, macro variables like interest rates and the price of oil, the stance of monetary policy, and geopolitical factors. The trades that live and breathe within the market are critical as well. The same investors who take risk also respond to it, and in so doing, create it. And in 1987, a critical tool for risk-taking was portfolio insurance. Here's what Dave Rogers, founder of JD Capital Management, had to say.
Certainly, I think portfolio insurance was at the heart of it. There may have been other kind of kickoffs or other catalysts for the start of it, but there's no question but that portfolio insurance exacerbated the entire move, not only in that day, but in, you know, subsequent days around and right after that. You know, to put it in pretty simple terms, it's just stop losses gone crazy in a large institutional sense. That's what it was. People felt that they could own more equities because this process of delevering and portfolio insurance as a whole was going to protect them on the way down. And, you know, it didn't quite work the way people hoped or thought it might work. And, you know, we have different versions of this and with different names and different flavors of it have existed and still exist today.
I like that. A giant stop-out trade. Some might call it the keyhole effect. Among the assumptions of models like Black-Scholes is the notion of continuous trading and infinite liquidity. On most days in markets, it's a fair assumption. But what happens if there's too much capital effectively ready to pull the ripcord at once? In the period leading into the 87 crash, portfolio insurance had become a large enough overlay in the market for it to matter. About the learning experience of the crash, Andy Constan, founder of Damped Spring Advisors, offered this.
And I had a transformative experience being asked to represent Salomon Brothers on the Brady Commission, which investigated why the stock market crashed in 1987, what the market mechanisms that caused such a rapid fall in the markets. That really got me involved in understanding how various people in the markets and the way they participate in the markets, their flow, their positioning, their strategies, interact with available liquidity and set prices.
As Andy references, the Brady Report was an effort to uncover the why of this cataclysmic sell-off. Here's some of what was reported on portfolio insurance. First, the take-up of this product was substantial, with 18 of the top 200 pension funds employing the strategy by 1986. The report tells us that an estimated $60 to $90 billion worth of portfolios were engaged in this, quote, hedging technique. And incredibly, assets under management of these programs had increased by fourfold in 1987 alone. Google wasn't around back then, but a database search of business periodicals showed one reference to portfolio insurance in 1980, one in 81, none in 82, one in 83, four in 1984, six in 1985, 41 in 1986, and 36 in 1987 before the crash. In the 3 months following the October 19th crash, there were 29 references. On the morning of the crash, with the market already down 10%, the Brady Commission reported that models suggested that $12 billion of equities needed to be sold when in fact only $4 billion had been. Let's put that in some historical context. These days, there's a lot of dialogue on the, quote, gamma profile of the market, with great attention paid to the put spread collar on the S&P 500 that is rolled once a quarter. When the gamma gets to more than a billion, that is to say that there is $1 billion of notional of the S&P to buy or sell on a 1% move, the chorus of commentators grows louder that the market may be pushed around. The market cap of the S&P 500 today is $30 trillion. In October 1987, it was less than a tenth of that. So the liquidity demands of the portfolio insurers on this day were indeed gigantic. Rick Bookstaber, founder of Fabric IQ, framed the imbalance this way.
There's one group that has to sell very quickly for one reason or another. It could be margin calls. It could just be because they have some program, which was the case in 87, that dictates that they sell more and more the further the market drops. But for one reason or another, the market drops in a very quick and violent way because of huge liquidity demand, people who are demanding very instantaneous levels of selling. But the people on the other side, the people who would supply liquidity, are not as quick on the trigger. And so you get this asynchronous behavior where the people who sell want to sell very fast, but the people who would buy from them are just not in a hurry.
Asset price wreckage on such a scale does not go unnoticed by those pulling the levers of policymaking. For Alan Greenspan, just 3 months into his tenure as head of the Fed, the crash motivated decisive action. Often known for his efforts at purposeful obfuscation, Greenspan is quoted as having said, quote, "I guess I should warn you, if I turn out to be particularly clear, you've probably misunderstood what I said." In the days following October 19th, 1987, Greenspan saw little need for nuance. The Fed sought, through both forceful words and actions, to push back against the potential for systemic instability. I often say that risk on and risk off can be curious cousins. These two opposites tend to enable one another. Long periods of stability sow the seeds of their own demise. Conversely, it's a risk-off event that, when material enough, creates the opportunity to make money quickly, as the policymakers swoop in to enforce stability, empowering investors to deploy capital on newly cheapened assets and rich in vol. Reflecting on the interaction between asset prices and powerful entities like the Federal Reserve, Jeff DeGraff, the founder of Renaissance Macro, said this.
There's a certain cadence to the market. There's a certain predictability from a policy response standpoint and the like. And so helping to create that framework and again, back to long-term capital, or even probably 11 years prior to that, which was the crash of 1987, which was really probably the first institution of the Greenspan put, starting to understand what these policy responses are, how far the dislocation has to go before you expect that the policy responses take place. But all those are part of that calculus.
Jeff's assessment here leads us to a broader consideration for risk-taking, and that is trading the policy response. If prices plummet, how might central banks respond? How might that response then impact pricing on both a relative and absolute basis? If there's one investor credited with best understanding this in the context of the 87 crash, it was Paul Tudor Jones. His chief strategist, Peter Borish, said, quote, "I think that Paul's greatest skill was realizing that people were going to drive to the place of most liquidity, and that was going to be fixed income." Borish goes on to say, quote, "The irony is that everyone thinks Paul made all his money being short stocks, but there wasn't that much liquidity in stock index futures. A lot of the opportunity to be made was in bond futures on the assumption that the Fed would supply a lot of liquidity. Paul didn't make as much in 10-year futures per contract as he did on S&P futures, but he did make more in the aggregate." And to tie these momentous market moves 3.5 decades ago to now, one can't help but think about the interaction of risky and risk-free asset prices. In the multi-year period before the 87 crash, stock and bond prices moved together. Those were simpler times, before the vastly complex web of overlapping counterparty system was created, before credit derivatives, and certainly well before the central banks themselves became the biggest investor in risk-free markets. The old adage went, just as the party's getting good, the Fed pulls away the punch bowl. Let's review what was happening in the period leading into October 1987. Inflation was rising steadily. Year-over-year CPI began 87 at just over 1%, but by October had reached 4.4%. 10-year rates followed, and by October, remarkably, peaked at 10.25%. I don't know about you, but a 10% yield on 10-year treasuries would motivate me to think long and hard about being long stocks. The correlation between stock and bond prices turned highly positive in the weeks preceding the crash, only to see it flip decidedly negative through the event itself as the Fed responded forcefully and there was a rush to safety that Tudor anticipated. In many ways, the 87 stock market crash was the original and most violent taper tantrum experienced by markets. The move in Eurodollar futures around the 87 crash was epic. From early September 87 to early November 87, the front month contract was unchanged. In between, rates went from 7.5% to 9.5% and then back to 7.5%. Barry Knapp, the founder of Ironsides Macroeconomics, recalled this.
So I started getting my MBA at night at Fordham and working at Fidelity Investments, running a retail or small institutional execution desk, which I was actually doing during the crash of 87, and had a class the night of the crash of 87, a finance class at Fordham, where we all talked about what had happened in the markets that day. And I'd been handling stock orders all day. Someone pointed out that the long bond had rallied 4 points. And I vaguely remember seeing that in the corner of my Quotron, that you'd had this ferocious rally, which of course became the start of tactical asset allocation, which was a big strategy for quite a long period of time.
Let's now turn to volatility. I've always liked this quote from derivatives pioneer, the late Mark Rubenstein. In putting some context to just how large the one-day move was, he said, quote, "Adherence of geometric Brownian motion or log-normally distributed stock returns must ever face a disturbing fact. Assuming that stock returns are log-normally distributed with about a 20% volatility, the probability that the stock market could fall 29% in a single day is 10 to the minus 160. So improbable is such an event that it would not be anticipated to occur even if the stock market were to last for 20 billion years, the upper end of the currently estimated duration of the universe. Indeed, such an event should not occur even if the stock market were to enjoy a rebirth for 20 billion years in each of 20 billion big bangs." I suppose this was Professor Rubenstein's way of suggesting that stock market returns are not really normally distributed. Asset price returns famously exhibit very fat tails. Let's look at the rich set of risk-off events that the last 3 decades have brought us. We saw swap spreads gap out in 1998 as LTCM imploded. In 2008, we saw U.S. financials move with shocking volatility. In 2015, we watched the Swiss National Bank walk away from its euro peg, leading to a 19% one-day move in the cross rate. We saw vol itself experience a giant tail event as the VIX complex blew up in early 2018. And just this month, a developed country bond market has crashed. In a week, the 30-year gilt fell by roughly 30%. This shocking loss of value might have been far worse had the Bank of England not been forced to step in on an emergency basis with a backstop program. The VIX wasn't around in 1987, but listed options were, and the CBOE has done us the favor of backfilling the data to give us an appreciation for where the VIX would have been during this calamitous time. You can find this on Bloomberg under the ticker VXO. You may know that the original VIX, as designed by Bob Whaley in 1993, was derived from OEX option prices. You know, the ones that Bernie Madoff so actively traded in his split-strike conversion strategy. We see that this old VIX, which did not bring in the entire surface of option prices, but did reflect at-the-money put-and-call implied volatilities, closed at the nice round number of 150 on October 19, 1987. Here's what Bob Whaley had to say about the crash.
What you saw in the days surrounding that is people rushed over and bought index puts. Listed index puts. They hadn't been doing that in great numbers beforehand, but they were looking for a substitute for this dynamic portfolio insurance, and the index puts became that substitute. Demand went way up, and what you saw in the implied volatility smile, it was no longer a smile. If you had a situation where implied volatilities for the puts, out-of-the-money puts, were extremely high, and for calls, they weren't.
Professor Whaley points to the manner in which the crash impacted the relative pricing of puts and calls. Harry Markopoulos said this.
If you remember the crash, we really didn't have skew. We didn't really know that out-of-the-money puts should have a different volatility than an out-of-the-money call. Things were priced wrong back then. People thought we knew about options, but we really did.
We often hear that you can't trade the spot VIX. And while true, we can trade instruments whose cost is directly related to the VIX level. What does a 150 VIX tell us about the cost of insurance during the crash? A one-month at-the-money put would cost a staggering 17% of notional. And this brings me to a topic I continue to find fascinating in markets, the time variation of risk premium levels. I recall hosting an investor dinner 5 years ago on October 19th, 2017, to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the crash. Volatility in 2017 was incredibly muted, and at this dinner, I reported that one-month SPX implied volatility was 6.6%, yielding a one-month at-the-money straddle cost of 1.5% of spot. While it was obvious, I couldn't help but make the point that owning this straddle would deliver profits at expiration if the S&P managed to finish either 1.5% higher or 1.5% lower. The 34% straddle cost on the day of the crash had dwindled to 1.5% on the same day 30 years later. This we might call the paradox of risk. When options are obscenely expensive on a nominal basis, investors can't buy them quickly enough. On the flip side, that 1.5% straddle 5 years ago sounded cheap, but I promise you, you couldn't have given it away. I'd like to close this retrospective with some thoughts on today's setup and market prices. In doing so, I share what Gerard Minack, founder of Minack Advisors, told us during an Alpha Exchange podcast. Recounting the 87 crash, Gerard said this.
I took over the publication, a quarterly publication, that had in its September quarter issue warned of an impending equity market crash. So on the day of the crash, there was phone calls into the organization I was working, say, put me through to the person responsible for that quarterly publication. And they said, well done on calling a crash. Right. I thought, well, that's the way to succeed. Call crashes.
Right.
And I've been calling crashes since. Not quite, but, you know, what I then learned, trying to call a few crashes, and for me in the equity space, because I start off in the rate space, you know, the most formative was the tech bubble, which I thought was a bubble. I thought it was bleeding. Obviously, it was a bubble. But I tell you what, fighting a bubble, ultimately, you do win, but it's very difficult.
The point here is that getting the view right isn't easy, but getting the view, the timing, and the trade construction all correct is really difficult. One might recall the giant losses suffered by Morgan Stanley during the Great Financial Crisis as a result of Howie Hubler's credit derivatives trade. Initially well-positioned with a large subprime short on, Hubler sought to defray the carry costs by selling a substantial amount of super senior protection. It all went horribly wrong. Yogi Berra once said, "You can observe a lot by watching." To that end, we know at this point that episodes of market crisis have commonality. The rich history of risk-offs is well worth studying. By doing so and gathering an appreciation of how and why these episodes of market disruption materialize, we arm ourselves with important context for understanding the present. When it comes to episodes of crisis, another yogiism should resonate. It's deja vu all over again. I hope you have enjoyed this retrospective episode on the 35th anniversary of the 1987 stock market crash. Thank you for listening to the Alpha Exchange.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.